BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello. It seems that the RNIB, the UK's largest and best-known organisation serving blind and partially sighted people, is at something of a crossroads. On the one hand, it's recently published a 10-year strategy with hugely ambitious targets to improve the lives of visually impaired people and improve the nation's eye health. On the other, they've also just completed a 45-day consultation with their staff, which we know will involve the loss of many jobs, including those of some blind staff, and the cutting, in some cases scrapping, of some much cherished services. Part of the background to this, discussed on this programme with the RNIB's CEO 9 months ago, was an estimated £10 million funding gap that had to be filled. The CEO, Matt Stringer, now joins us again with the consultation just completed. Matt Stringer, that circle, hugely ambitious aims and a need to cut jobs and services, sounds like a pretty difficult one to square. How can it be done?
Well, I think we are doing it, Peter. I mean, first of all, you know, as you said, we've got an ambitious vision in which the UK works equitably for blind and partially sighted people. And a strong RNIB, you've called as a leading charity in the sector, is clearly critically important to help make that happen. And the programme we've just gone through, and I'm sure we'll come and talk about it a bit more now, I think has a number of aims, which I think we've been able to achieve. You know, building an organisation that is better able to support blind and partially sighted people into the future. And I think also, crucially, setting us up to absorb, you know, the headwinds from a very challenging world and critically put us on a sustainable financial footing.
But you do have to lose jobs. Can we talk about those first? Because it's about people, visually impaired people. I mean, how many redundancies have you had to make?
Yeah, well, first of all, you know, we're incredibly sorry for any colleagues, sighted or visually impaired, who have had to leave the organisation. In total, we will lose 190 colleagues. And of those 190 colleagues, 24 visually impaired colleagues will leave the organisation. 8 of those took voluntary redundancy, actually, and the other 16, I'm afraid we had to make compulsory redundant. You know, we've done as much as we can to try and support that process with a lot of outplacement support, support around equipment, and extending the use of accessible software for a period after they've left the organisation.
Isn't it very embarrassing, not to mention damaging to the organisation's reputation, to have to get rid of the very people you're urging other employers to take on, people who you're assuring them, quite rightly, are valuable and resourceful workers?
I don't think it's embarrassing. I think it's tough and hard. I get that for everybody involved. I think I'd point to our work on employment outside the RNIB. You know, critically, we're trying to get the UK to work better for blind and partially sighted people. And last year, we helped over 1,000 people retain their jobs. We actually helped just short 500 people into work. And actually, we're trying to help ourselves by developing internal visually impaired talent. We just put in place a lived experience leadership programme with our good friends at Guide Dogs and Thomas Pocklington Trust, exactly to sort of train up talented visually impaired colleagues in the sector.
But so, Matt, we know a lot.
I think we've got a good track record.
We know a lot of employers, an alarming amount, are saying we're not going to make adaptations and we can't make adaptations to employ visually impaired people. If they see the RNIB isn't able to employ that quota of visually impaired people, they're going to say, well, if they won't, why should we?
Well, Peter, I get the contradiction that you're raising in your question. As I say, we're very sorry anyone's had to leave the organisation, including those 24 visually impaired colleagues. I think we've signed up 37 new employers to our visibly better employer standards last year, which is the programme that helps them sort of recruit, induct and support and sustain blind and partially sighted people in the work. I think we've got a strong track record there, which people see as being very robust and credible at the moment.
Quite a lot of these people have very specific skills related to the very fact that they are blind or partially sighted. Some have been with you for many years and are nearing the end of their working lives. I mean, I've heard the words brutal, uncaring mentioned in the context of these redundancies. I know you won't agree with that, but that's how it's being seen by some of the people in the organisation that we've talked to.
We have run this programme over 9 months. We've been very engaged with the unions to make sure the programme is absolutely legal, fair, watertight. All along the way, we've run monthly all-hands communication sessions where we've been very open about the programme progress. And at the end, we ran a 45-day consultation where we had 50 counter proposals, and we accepted 21 of those, which put 10 roles back in and made a variety of changes to processes and structures. So I think we set out, and I think we did deliver a program which allowed input and was as considerate as we could be in a circumstance.
Can we come to a proposed cut, which has, I know you know, caused a considerable upset in the blind community and which has now been postponed for a year? That's the proposed scrapping of the Braille transcription service. Now, this came at a time when the RNIB has been marking, indeed celebrating, the 200th anniversary of the invention of Braille. So the question now is, why was it even considered?
We do understand this is a vitally important service for the users, and we've had a lot of, as you just indicated, Peter, sort of very sort of impassioned feedback last week, which we've listened to. We couldn't really sustain the operation ourselves, honestly, and to move it to another provider, and we will stand behind that for the next 12 months and actually working with people to put in place a solution that will endure beyond the year. And I think what we're keen to do in that process is get society to stand behind its obligations to produce information, which at the moment the RNIB is doing, when other organisations should do that. It's been a bit of a misstep, Peter, I get it, and we've corrected that, and we will make sure that we run a very considered and consultative process now with all the users that came forwards in the last few weeks.
But it does raise a concerning issue. I mean, I said there was a lot of opposition to this. One of its users, Connor Scott Gardner, put out an open letter on this. I'd like you to hear specifically what they said about the issue of the numbers affected, 500, as compared to those who used the large print transcription service, which was scheduled to continue.
The RNIB is here to support blind people. Some of those blind people are totally blind to very limited amounts of vision and will be Braille readers. When I had a friend who the other day said he feels, and I agree with him, like congenitally blind people are being really pushed to the side. We can talk numbers all day, but if they are going to be the Royal National Institute of Blind People, they need to support blind people and not say, oh, well, you're actually too expensive. You cost too much money, so we'll only support the blind people that cost us less money. And then I think there's a broader question of actually, well, if they're not going to provide services that blind people need, what function do they serve? Or are they only serving a very narrow demographic? And in which case, then they have no right to speak for us when it's convenient for them.
I mean, that is the issue I wanted you to address, which is this feeling that perhaps congenitally blind people, you know, are losing some of those very specialised services, the very services the RNIB was set up to provide.
Yeah, well, I mean, we set up in 1868, you know, for the improvement of embossed literature of the blind. And I think, you know, we stand behind that position. It's been in our DNA for 150 years. On the personal transcription side, in the last 4 months, we've had 507 commissions, actually. About 60% of that is large format. As I say, it's been a bit of a misstep from the RNIB. We will correct that and we will stand behind it. But I think there's a critical point here. And first of all, we do offer a breadth and depth of Braille provision, which is unrivaled. And I think, you know, that needs to be acknowledged, and that hasn't changed. That's not going away anywhere. And if anything, we've seen with the changes we've made over the last few years, more users use those services.
But the transcription service has only been postponed. Will it quietly disappear in a year's time when the heat's off?
No, Peter, I don't think so, honestly. I mean, you know, I'm here, I'm heavily involved in this. I think we'll fix this in the next few months, frankly. You know, it's a very live issue now. We're not going to kick it in the long grass. Yeah, we've got a great provider, which I think many of the people who fed back to us over the weekend and last week use themselves anyway. So that's a credible, very credible source of production, frankly, more credible than our operation would have been going into the future. Mm. But ultimately, there will be, I'm sure, an element the RNIB has to stand behind, you know, from the end of the year. And that will be something that we will do.
Let's talk about some of the changes that are going to be introduced, which people will notice. There's talk of a one-stop shop when people call in for help or advice. What's the idea behind that? Because some jobs have gone in your customer-facing services. I'm wondering how people are going to get quicker advice with less people to filter out calls and give it.
Yeah, I mean, Peter, we'll still have about 500 people working in our service team going forward, which is about half the numbers in the RNIB. So it's still a massive part of our operation. I think what we've been seeing is we've had pockets of our teams who've had a particular specialism, and actually we haven't really dealt with things efficiently in managing the ebb and flow of requests coming in. What we're trying to do is have a much better sort of initial sort of layer of support and service from the first point of contact into the RNIB. If I give you an example, our Tech for Life service, which we've called Digital Skills now, we've had 2,500 customers contact that service in the last 6 months since we've been live. So this is a real life sort of example. And of those, only 93 sort of contacts did we have to take that issue back into the organisation to be addressed and worked on to come back to the customer. If you look at the previous 6 months, we had to take 700 of those queries back into the organisation, you know, and therefore the service wasn't that efficient.
You mentioned the Technology for Life scheme. The worry that some people had, and I talked to some people about this, was that, again, you lost some visually impaired people at that point. And the worry is that the idea that you've got now will mean you've had to train up people when you already had people doing this kind of job. This is a very specialised area, and the worry is the advice will be from people who perhaps don't fully understand that specialisation.
Yeah, we're not going to be doing that. I mean, we've got areas of speciality, things like tax and welfare, and we've mentioned technology. You know, we're absolutely retaining the core skills in those teams, honestly, and trying to upskill others to be broader in their knowledge. So
you have had to upskill people to do jobs that skillful people were already doing?
No, I think we're just adding to it. We're creating a greater layer of service because, you know, we're getting more people able to deal with more of the queries.
Much of the new emphasis from your strategy seems to be on changing attitudes to blindness through advocacy. The trouble with that, surely, is that success is very hard to measure and often very slow in coming. Don't visually impaired people need services rather than a constant attempt to persuade other people to provide the services that you should be providing, or asking them to behave better?
Well, I think it's both, Peter, isn't it? I think the organisation at the moment is able to do that. Part of the reason why we've gone through this programme is to, you know, set us up to be able to carry on over the medium term, you know, be able to spin both those plates. You know, some of those areas in which we would campaign aren't things that we would offer the service. For example, the ticket office closure campaign, well, we won Civil Society's campaign of the year for the work we did there. You know, we do think we can move the dial on things like eye care, on travel and transport, on employment, on education, because if the RNIB isn't campaigning on those things, then who is?
But I want to give you some example of those. There's some of those ambitions that, and goals in your future strategy. I quote, "To ensure every person with sight loss can live the life they want to lead without limits. We need everybody to care about and prioritise eye health. Everyone with sight loss can make spontaneous journeys and travel the way they want to. A 3-year target, everyone who loses their sight and needs support to relearn skills will get access to vision rehabilitation." Now, they're great aims. No one would argue with any of them, but I don't really see anything in the strategy and the consultation which shows how it's going to be any easier to get those things done than it was before.
Well, I think we are making some progress on some of those things. I mean, we wouldn't put them in and then not have a view as to how we could do them. I mean, I think take something like
rehab for everybody in 3 years' time. You've been campaigning on this for 30 years. It hasn't happened because the local authorities haven't got the money to do it.
Yeah, but I think let's pick up a couple of things there. First of all, on sort of eye care and eye health, one of the things we are investing in this strategy is our eye care liaison officers and actually having, you know, getting to a sort of 100% coverage, you know, by 2027. I mean, yeah, working with government and local government is tough, money's tight, but rehabilitation in its widest sense is working on access to technology. There's different ways, you know, to try and bring this about. So, you know, I know there's a sort of lofty aspirations, but if the RNIB doesn't have lofty aspirations, who should? And I think you can see some tangible signs of life in the things I've just mentioned as examples.
I just want to come back, as we're near the end of this, on the feel of the organisation. There is this strong impression amongst the blind people that we've been talking to that it's very top-down, that decisions are being handed down without much consultation, and you might take the transcription service as an example, largely by sighted people. This is what Steve Tyler, a former RNIB senior officer, said when we talked to him a few weeks ago.
More and more, we're seeing voluntary sector organisations being driven by very, very commercial decision-making processes. If you begin to focus much more on brand and reach and all of those things, you begin to lose sight of the services and the importance of the relationship. At the moment, if you look at the leadership in RNIB, and I'm not talking about trustees here, I'm talking about the senior leadership team, to my knowledge, there are no visually impaired staff at the top table and very few at the next level down. That's concerning. If you don't have people leading the ambition that genuinely can represent the needs and speak on behalf of people with visual impairment, I think that's a real challenge.
Matt, you know, the suggestion, too money orientated, too few visually impaired people in positions to guide and influence policy. With 6 years now in the job behind you, what do you say to that?
First of all, I mean, Steve's, you know, wanted to discount the trustees. I would include the trustees. I mean, you know, the trustees here play a massive part, have done since we came out of the statutory inquiry. We have a visually impaired chair in Anna Tyler, as you know, and our statutes are that one of the chair of the CEO needs to be visually impaired to make sure we have that visually impaired leadership in the very upper reach of the organisation.
Is one enough?
I was going to say, in my time, you know, more than half of the trustees have been visually impaired. We appointed 3 new trustees last year. They were all visually impaired. And the trustees play an incredibly sort of hands-on role in steering and guiding the organisation. In terms of the senior leadership team, you know, one of the things we do when we go out to recruit roles is the number one criterion with recruitment consultants is to find visually impaired candidates. And we're bending over backwards to scour the market to try and find people. You know, we've lost a couple of visually impaired execs in David Clark and Keith Valentine in my time.
You give those two examples. Have they been replaced by visually impaired people?
No, they haven't. But I'm going to come to say one of them has an 11-year-old visually impaired son. It's not lived experience, but I think we would call it learned experience. And we just recruited a new CFO who's gone through a lot of retinal surgery recently at Moorfields. So again, some understanding of how the health system does or doesn't work, you know, around eye care. Steve mentioned the commercial side of things there. Maybe just touch on that. Organisations need money. You know, it's tough out there. And it's not wrong to try and be commercial when it comes to diversifying income streams and making money. Charities need to get a balance, don't they, between having the money coming in and be able to support all the services that we spent, you know, the last few minutes talking about. So I think, you know, we constantly strive to get as much visually impaired leadership in the organisation as possible. And I think we're probably striking the balance about right between the commercial mindset and the charity mindset.
Matt, 6 years behind you, but at the end of the all-staff meeting the other day, you announced that you were leaving the RNIB at the end of this year. Why now, just when these changes have been put in place, which you've been advocating and defending?
Well, I've done 7 years by then, Peter. It's been my 50s, honestly. I think we're in good shape. You know, I started when we were coming out of the statutory inquiry, or we're in the statutory inquiry, spent 2 years helping us get out of it. And it was a real existential crisis, I think, for the RNIB. 6 years later, we're in much better nick.
Has this been a tougher job than you expected?
It's been a complete privilege to have the job. I mean, you know, I do get how important the RNIB is in society for blind and partially sighted people, both in terms of service provision and advocacy. I think any job in the charity sector is a big challenging job, and this is a good time with the organisation in a really stable position. You know, able to hand over the baton to someone who'll be very lucky to take over from me.
Matt Stringer, thank you very much for joining us. We'd like to hear your views on all the issues that we've raised and any you think we should have done but didn't. You can email in touch at bbc.co.uk.